Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is Phoenix Bond and Indemnity Company against Bridge. Mr. Sacknoff.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'll start with the district court's opinion, what it got right and where it went astray. That'll lead into the zone of interest test raised by this court in Israel and by the district court. And then, with time remaining, if there is, I'll focus on the Supreme Court's opinion in ANZA to show that the plaintiffs also meet the three-part test for proximate cause. And, Your Honors, first, the district court was correct in finding that only the plaintiffs and not the treasurer, not the property owners or victims who suffer financial loss from the defendant's fraudulent scheme, the treasurer isn't a victim because whether or not the room is packed with the defendant's affiliates, all the delinquent taxes are promptly paid, the property owners don't suffer any losses because all the tax liens were bid and sold at the lowest possible penalty rate of zero.
Does the record reveal why the lowest possible penalty rate is zero? You could have a negative number there.
That would be interesting because then there could be some competitive bidding, but the statute requires that the tax liens be sold to those tax buyers who bid the lowest possible rate. And because there are no negative numbers, it's zero. And since the Phoenix Bond case where there was competition...
And there are no negative numbers because the statute forbids negative bids?
The statute is silent on negative bids, but I think that the implication is that you can't go below zero. I think the legislature could have provided...
The Greeks thought that, but the Indians showed that was wrong.
I think the analog to that would be if the legislature had permitted the tax buyers to compete at these sales by bidding for the value of the liens, but Your Honor, the legislature has handed the treasurer a rent seeker's market here in which they can all bid zero and still make good profits on the liens that they purchase.
That's the source of the fact that there'll be multiple winning bids. It's that the auction is constrained.
That's correct. It's really a negative auction. And the problem is that the legislature has handed the treasurer this problem. I mean, what does she do when everybody bids zero? How do you apportion the liens? Now, enter the single bidder rule, which is designed to promote a fair and honest auction in which the liens are distributed, really parceled out in some sort of non-random or worse, some favoritism way. So together with the single bidder rule and the rotational system, that really provides or establishes the basis, the context in which the defendants have now cast their lot with the single bidder rule. I think it's a false dichotomy to say it's got to either be mail fraud or the single bidder rule, but let's test it in terms of Your Honor's opinion in Israel Travel, where it wasn't the proximate cause test, but the zone of interest.
Why isn't this just a problem for the treasurer's office? If somebody's packing the auction with related bidders, why doesn't the treasury office just be alerted to that fact, look into it, and take whatever corrective action would be necessary?
Your Honor, that's a good question. It's the third test in the Supreme Court's opinion in ANZA. Is there somebody better able to enforce the rule? And the problem is that the treasurer has taken no action in 4 years, none, in spite of the fact that there are a lot of signs that the defendants had packed the room with affiliates. And the treasurer really doesn't have the resources, and she has said that. I'm perfectly willing to add facts if necessary. We've put a footnote in our reply brief indicating that she doesn't have the resources. But I think that this is a case in which Congress has specifically permitted in 1964 private plaintiffs to enforce the rule, the statute. And therefore, she suffers no loss, Judge Evans. In other words, the treasurer's office doesn't have a financial interest at all in whether or not the room is packed. Chaos would be an interest, obviously, if 100 bidders showed up. If the defendants had packed the room with not 20 or 30 bidders, but 50, and there's no way that the plaintiffs can protect themselves against this. As Judge Easterberg indicated, it would be hard to bid a negative number, zero, and at the same time, they can't really protect themselves because the only way they could do that would be if they packed the room, if they lied to the treasurer with their certifications and attempted to pack the room themselves. So the single bidder rule is designed to promote fairness in this reverse auction, in this rent-seeking auction. Now, granted, they're free riders here, too, but the plaintiffs and the principal defendants are the largest, in terms of financial buys, the largest tax buyers in the room. And because of that, they're the ones who suffer the most, who've been injured, or as Judge Scalia said in his concurrence, I believe he said that the zone of interest rule is designed to determine who is sought to be protected by the rule. Now, we don't have any legislative history about this rule, but we've got to read it on its face and read it in terms of what it really means, which is to prevent the room from being packed unfairly with people who cheat, with people who are affiliated with other bidders and capture liens from those persons who were in the room legitimately and ought to be able to have their fair share. So in looking at who is losing out and why, the only logical, the only real-world victims here are the tax buyers who don't get their fair share of the liens. And, Your Honor, this is not a case in which you can talk about which generalities or labels like primary or intended victims. I think Your Honor's opinion that you wrote in EDC is applicable here. The defendants seem to think that Israel Travel has overruled EDC, and they're wrong in that. The analysis that Your Honor Judge Posner used there was, it's not a case of transferred intent where you shoot at X and hit Y by mistake. It's really a case where you shoot down the plane intending to kill X, but you kill Y at the same time. Here, there isn't any question that the intended victims of the fraud that was committed here by the defendants, the intended victims are the plaintiffs who didn't get their fair share of liens. I don't think there's any other rational way that that can be analyzed. So I think that in the context of the single bidder rule that the defendants have cast their lot with.
Well, there's the idea they're all bidding the same, and so just as a matter of chance, if there are more of these affiliates in there, there's just less probability of you getting a bid.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. It's really a matter of it's math. And I think we've maybe oversimplified the illustration of A, B, and C in our reply brief, but the more of the defendant's affiliates are in the room, the less tax liens, these valuable tax liens, the plaintiff's buyers.
But I mean, are all the bids the same, and so they're just assigned randomly?
No, it's not random at all, Your Honor. We've pled that there's a rotational system. And I'm sorry.
I mean, if you're the low bidder, you get the...
Absolutely. But if 50 people are low bidders, the treasurer was stuck in the sense, what does she do?
Well, that was my question. Does everybody bid the same?
Everybody bids zero. That's correct.
But is that the only dimension of the auction?
It's the only dimension of the auctions that are involved in this case. And the reason for that, Your Honor, is that tax buyers can make a really good profit.
I mean, are you saying that if you submitted a tenth of the bids, you get a tenth of the liens?
If the auction were a fair auction and there were no...
No, forget that. If you submit 10% of the bids, does it mean you get 10% of the liens?
That's correct.
So
just that math.
So if there are more bidders and the same number of liens, you get a smaller percentage.
That's correct, Your Honor. And again, under... In terms of damages here, the defendants take us to task for not being able to establish that we didn't get this lien, didn't bid on that lien and all. But they cite no authority for the requirement to plead damages with that kind of specificity. And, Your Honor, Judge Easterbrook, Your Honor's opinion...
Well, are you seeking equitable relief or damages?
No, we're seeking damages, Your Honor. And we can we have damage models in which we're able to establish, because every tax lien has a paper trail, and we can tell how much profit was earned on that lien. We're seeking damage.
Why aren't you seeking equitable relief also?
Well, we didn't have a chance.
Want to end this, or maybe it has ended.
It's a serious question whether private plaintiffs can seek equitable relief under RICO. Our court is something of an outlier in that respect.
Thank you, Judge Easterbrook. That's where I was going. But the equitable relief wouldn't really have helped us in terms of recovering the damages that we suffered for the four years.
Future, don't you want to end this?
No, Your Honor, we've been all over the treasurer to attempt to get her and the state's attorney to attempt to, I'm moving into my time now, to take some action, but they've never done that, and we believe it's been in reliance on the fact that they know that we as private plaintiffs...
Do you have a state remedy?
I'm sorry?
Do you have a state law remedy?
Under the property code, anybody who violates it, I assume, would be subject to a state law remedy. But as I said before, the treasurer has shown no interest.
No, but I mean, you couldn't seek an injunction under state law?
I think we probably could have done that, but again, we did not because it was damages that we were seeking.
Before you did I hear you say that this state's attorneys who looked at this will not bring an action because they want you to enforce the civil RICO case? Is that what you were saying?
Judge Evan, that's sort of an oversimplification, but we have talked to the...
What did you just say?
Well, no, what I said was that we've talked to the state's attorneys, we've talked to the treasurer, and they have simply indicated that they are not going to take any action, period.
But you said because you have this civil RICO remedy.
I think the implication is because when we talked to them, they knew we'd already filed the complaint, that they figured that we would carry the load. I believe that that's the truth, sir.
Okay.
Can't prove that, but I believe it.
Yeah, be a hard one to prove.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Becker.
To start where Mr. Sacknoff left off with Judge Evans' question, the treasurer's rule itself is the explanation why the state's attorney will take no action. It states expressly the determination of whether registered entities are related so as to prevent the entities from bidding at the same time is in the sole and exclusive discretion of the Cook County Treasurer or her designated representatives. And she also states in the very same rule, as in prior tax...
What are you reading from?
I'm sorry, I'm reading from the rule itself, from the single simultaneous bidder, the notification that the treasurer gives out, and it's attached to the complaint in this case.
Mm-hmm.
She says, as in prior tax sales, the Cook County Treasurer will enforce the single simultaneous bidder entity rule. So, you know, we have already gone into the realm of speculation as to why she has not proceeded against the defendants for a violation of the rule. One very good explanation could be that although the plaintiffs, as they admit, have urged the treasurer to proceed, the treasurer has simply found no violation of the rule because she has the sole discretion to determine what a related entity is, and if she doesn't find these defendants to be related entities, no matter what the plaintiffs say, then there's been no misrepresentation. The other explanation is that she has the discretion. And this rule, I don't believe, can be read independent of the property tax code. And the purpose of the property tax code, as found by the Illinois Supreme Court in the first Phoenix Bond case, is to protect the property owners, not to protect the bidders. That goes back to 1897.
Why, in your view, is a negative bid not allowed? The property owners would certainly be protected by negative bids.
Well, to implement the negative bid would be an interesting thing. That would mean that the bidders would be, in effect, out of pocket, and they would...
Bidder pays, suppose the taxes are $1,000.
Right.
The bidder pays the $1,000 to the county and agrees to accept $900 from the property owner in full satisfaction. The bidder is still... You know, that can be the competitive solution if the bidder is going to manage to foreclose on a percentage of these properties. Where the source of profit is.
It would be an interesting idea, Judge Easterbrook, and the Illinois State Legislature would be the one to consider it.
Mr. Sacknoff said there was a statute, but said that in his reading the statute did not forbid negative bids. Do you read it to forbid negative bids?
I don't know, Your Honor. But assuming that it does forbid negative bids, then we know...
The only reason we are here, the only reason why this strategy of stuffing the cookie jar so you can be drawn out more often is a success, is that there are too many bidders at the winning bid. And if you allow full competition in the bids, that wouldn't occur. There'd be unique winning bidders.
Right. It's simply the other end of the spectrum from when everybody bid the maximum and the treasurer first enacted a rule. Her first approach to it was to forfeit the sale of any property to the state. That didn't work because the purpose of the property code is to dispose of the property.
There is something, neither side quite sure what, in state law, that prevents any bonus bid, any negative percentage at this auction. Then the county is essentially out of it. Both the county and the property holder are indifferent to who wins at the auction. The county can't get any more money if one person wins rather than another. The property owner can't get any more money.
Right.
The only person who is not indifferent are the bidders.
That's correct.
And doesn't it follow from that that the interested parties are exactly the plaintiffs in this suit? The county is indifferent. The property owner is indifferent. Who's left?
I think that the... plaintiffs are certainly interested parties, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're within the zone of interest of the mail fraud or statute or even the treasurer's rule.
But if the county has nothing to gain or lose by this rule, and the property owners have nothing to gain or lose by this rule, if we say that the other bidders are not within the zone of interest, that's just saying this rule isn't enforceable and fraud is fine.
Well, no, because first of all...
One can imagine parallel circumstances. One that came to mind as I was thinking about this case is what happened in SEC against Jaskolski, where Mr. Jaskolski, an associate at a law firm, pretended to be a shareholder of an SNL in the process in which it converts from mutual to public form in order to get a larger percentage of the mutual shares. Didn't affect the price they were going to sell it for, didn't affect the fact that it was converting, but it affected who got what allocation of shares. And that was prosecuted as a fraud against Mr. Jaskolski, and so we held here. And this looks very similar to that. This is a kind of deceit that affects percentage ownership, but not price. And if Jaskolski is right, what's wrong with this lawsuit?
There's a difference, because the treasurer does have an interest, and the treasurer has an interest in an orderly sale. Without the rule itself, in other words, the heart of the plaintiff's case is their allegation that there was a misrepresentation made to the treasurer that these defendants were not related entities. If there was no rule, I think it's very clear there'd be no RICO action, because there'd be nothing even remotely to base a fraud on. The rule reserves to the treasurer the sole discretion to determine what a related entity is and to enforce it. And I submit, Your Honor, that the treasurer does have an interest. It's actually a paramount interest in an orderly sale process.
Well, If everybody tells the truth to the treasurer and the treasurer just finds that the defendant entities are not related, then there's no claim of fraud. But we have to assume at this stage of the litigation, since we're on the complaint, that the treasurer was being lied to.
Right.
Then I don't understand how the fact that the treasurer can interpret the rule matters at this stage. You may have a perfect defense if this lawsuit goes forward.
Here's why. Let's assume that the treasurer was lied to about the existence of related entities among the defendants. Mm-hmm. And the rule prohibits contractual agreements among parties who are going to be bidding on properties, and also parties, they have to represent that they don't have an agreement to sell or purchase the property after they bid on the lien. That's in violation of the property tax code, because the property tax code provides that the lien shall be freely alienable. And therefore, you have an unenforceable rule in violation of state law that is the basis of this RICO action, even assuming that lies were told, which is why this case in the first instance belongs in the state court.
No, this is what's puzzling. So in an ordinary mail fraud case, you don't inquire into what the what the structure of enforcement is of the underlying, you know, anti-fraud law that's been violated, right?
That's quite correct, Judge Posner.
And so why does it matter that the rule says that the treasurer has the exclusive enforcement power?
Because this case is on the outer fringes of RICO to begin with. In the ordinary RICO case based on the predicate act of mail fraud.
I think that RICO has no core. It has only fringes.
I understand you have an argument about the mail. You know, the mail is too peripherally involved. I understand that. But
right.
If there is a fraud, and if the mail was used in furtherance of it, then I don't understand why the enforcement structure should make a difference.
Well, I think the enforcement structure makes a difference in several ways. First of all, if we go to the proximate cause analysis.
Oh, forget proximate cause. What does proximate cause mean anyway?
Well, the Supreme Court in ANZA said that that one of the tests, the third test Mr. Sacknoff referred to as well, is whether there are other so-called victims who are more likely or better positioned to.
And, no, I understand it's a legitimate question to ask whether you've got the wrong plaintiff in the sense that you've got a plaintiff who's actually pushing out of the way someone who has a greater interest in enforcing. I understand. You don't have to use a word like proximate cause for that.
Okay.
Right? If that's all you mean, fine. Now, if you have some other concept of proximate cause, some other monkey wrench to throw in their machinery, that's fine. But what you just described as proximate cause was just repeating the zone of interest, which is another bit of, you know, jargon, and which we could live without quite happily.
Well, I agree, and I think you say that quite well, Judge Posner. The bottom line is we have a rule that the plaintiffs cannot enforce. We also have a rule.
Why can't they enforce?
Because the Treasury is reserved.
But they're not enforcing, right? This is a fraud case.
But they can't even allege that there's fraud, and they can't. The ordinary rule under 12b-6 doesn't apply because only the treasurer has the sole discretion to determine who's a related entity.
Well, you keep coming back to that.
Right.
But as I say, an ordinary mail fraud criminal prosecution very often is based on state law, the use of the mails mm-hmm. to defraud a state official of something. And I can't think of any case where we've inquired into what kind of enforcement structure the state had. Now, are you arguing that somehow this lawsuit is going to disrupt the administration of the tax code?
Sure.
How does that happen?
Well, because depending on the outcome of this lawsuit will affect who is allowed to bid, who is allowed to come into the room, presumably. When the treasurer had a situation where there weren't enough bidders and there wasn't an open market for these liens, then the result was that everybody bid 18% and the property owners were harmed, and that's why the treasurer enacted the first rule.
But to get back to Judge Easterbrook's question, what if all that's involved here is lying to the treasurer? Why should she care that those lies are being punished? Well, how does that hurt her?
Frankly, as long as she's getting a zero penalty interest rate, which is the lowest rate, and that's her interest, and that's her mandated interest under the property tax code, I don't think she does care. But
well,
the fact
if she doesn't care, then why shouldn't the people who are hurt by this fraud have a remedy?
Because their so-called fraud is predicated on her rule, which only she can enforce. And if that rule went away tomorrow.
You're going back to the enforcement structure. That's a loser as far as I'm concerned.
But no, with due respect, Ryan, I'm going back to whether or not they have any predicate act at all to base a RICO action on.
All you need for a predicate act is to have a fraud, right?
They
plus
don't have
the mail. I mean, you have to have the mail. You have to have a mail fraud.
Right. They don't have a fraud, Your Honor, unless the
Why
treasurer...
Why don't they have a fraud?
They don't have a fraud unless the treasurer finds that the defendants are related entities and lied about it.
Well, that's what's so strange.
Yeah, but that's the problem, since we have to assume at this stage the treasurer is being lied to and can't make an intelligent decision about that. And when I keep thinking about parallels in securities law, and maybe that's a mistake, but do you know the O'Hagan case?
Yes.
In the Supreme Court that the tender offer bidder tells the lawyer, keep your mouth shut, this is confidential information. The tender offer bidder presumably could have changed that instruction, could have allowed the lawyer to trade. But the lawyer, in violation of the instruction, goes ahead and trades and is convicted of securities fraud. The fraud is on the bidder, not on the investors, even though the bidder could have allowed the lawyer to do what he was doing, but the bidder was not being told the truth. Now, isn't that parallel to what's going on here? The treasurer could have allowed these entities to bid, but the treasurer wasn't being told the truth and so couldn't make an intelligent decision. And the responsible party is the one who doesn't tell the truth to the treasurer or to the bidder.
But there's
Mr. O'Hagan's now out of jail, but he learned that that was, you know, a good definition of fraud.
But as Mr. Sacknoff told the court, they've been to the treasurer and they've been to the state's attorney, and both have declined to find a violation of the rule. I think, you know, under those circumstances.
It sounded from Mr. Sacknoff like they have declined to file litigation, which is different from saying they have declined to find a violation of the rule.
No, I wasn't part of his conversation, but I think it's a distinction without a difference.
No, I'm totally lost. If somebody takes a drug case to the U.S. attorney and he says, I'm not going to prosecute, do you think that means that there was no violation of the drug laws or just that he's got better things to do with his time?
It could be either.
It could be either. Right. It does not mean I'm now finding there was no violation of the drug laws.
No, I don't believe I said that. I thought the difference was between whether they found a violation or just declined to file litigation. I don't think they need to file litigation to find a violation because the treasurer has discretion to find the violation. But it's her sole discretion. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Becker.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Sacknoff?
Not much.
Well, I have
a question
about the mail aspect of this. What is the?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear it.
What is the? The mail doesn't seem to have been used in furtherance of this scheme.
Well, Your Honor, in order for the defendants to be able to earn profits on the liens that they purchase, they must cause the mails to be used to send these notices to the delinquent taxpayers. Three notices.
It's so peripheral.
Oh, but Your Honor, no mailings.
As if they're using the mailing to arrange the
Your Honor, with all
fraud.
Due respect, I have to differ.
It's irrelevant.
Well, let me.
It's irrelevant.
Your Honor, without the mailings, they don't earn any profits on the liens. And there are a whole flock of cases that we've cited here that make it fairly clear that the defendants don't have to receive the mailings as long as the mailings are instrumental in being able to accomplish the fraud. And they are here. I don't know how else to say this. Your Honor.
Your theory is basically the one involved in Schmuck against the United States.
I'm familiar with that case, and that's true. We did cite, I think, Schmuck. In fact, we did cite it. But
That's the one where the mailings were to the state to change title on the vehicles, even though
correct.
Those mailings were completely truthful.
Right.
But if you couldn't change the title, you couldn't make any money from rolling back the odometer.
And Judge Posner, these mailings are entirely truthful. They're mailings to the delinquent taxpayers saying, if you don't come in and pay the taxes, you're going to lose your property. One of the reasons I liked your analogy.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Finish.
I'm saying, but one of the reasons I liked your analogy, Judge Posner, in EDC, I just pulled it out, you never utter the word proximate cause at all. You look at the facts and you say, sure, those creditors.
Wait, I don't know. I don't understand how proximate cause gets
well,
in.
I'm not.
I was concerned about the mail, about the use of the mail coming so late in the. The fraud is complete. Just notifying the taxpayer about his, you know, opportunities to redeem and so forth. That occurs after the fraud is complete.
The fraud is complete when there is injury, and the plaintiffs were injured when the defendants captured liens.
You're injured when your bid isn't accepted.
No, Your Honor, that's just so like getting out of the starting gate
and
the injury.
No. That's the whole point. If you don't get your bid accepted, you never get the lien.
But Your Honor, how could we recoup the profits here that the defendants earned?
What do you mean recouping profits? Your When the treasurer turns down your bid because of all these additional illegal bidders, then you're out. You're finished. Right?
It is the beginning of being... No, Your Honor, I disagree with that. It's the beginning of being finished, but the steps necessary in order to complete this fraud are to mail mailings out to property owners to collect the subtaxes and maybe get the deeds if they don't redeem. There's no other way that we could compute our losses without the fact that those mailings are essential to the defendants getting what we should have gotten at this reverse auction. I see my red light is on.
This might be, I know your light's on, but
sure.
This might be a dumb question, but why, if you say they are violating this simultaneous bidder
right.
rule by what they're doing, and they make an explanation, and the treasurer says no violation, why can't you do exactly the same thing that they're doing?
Oh, and Your Honor,
pack the room with
we're
bidders.
Because we're upstanding citizens, Your Honor. We're not going to lie to the treasurer.
Well, wait, you went to the Illinois Supreme Court saying this rule wasn't any good.
No, but it's an interesting question, Your Honor, but we're not going to lie to the treasurer and pack the room ourselves. What I would like to do, and maybe if Your Honors want to know about it, I can check the statute, because Judge Easterbrook has raised this interesting question about bidding negatively. And we didn't plead it. It's not part of our complaint, but it's an interesting concept. And, again, it's for the next case, because I think there could be a real competitive market if you could bid zero or, better yet, bid the value of the properties. That's what the legislature should do to correct this rent-seeking market, Your Honors. Mm-hmm. No other questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement. Case